This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McKee. The U.S. Senate confirmed federal appellate judge Amy Coney Barrett to the seat on the Supreme Court in a 52-48 vote late Monday. Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine joined the entire Democratic caucus voting against Barrett's confirmation. Collins said she would not vote for Barrett's confirmation because of the proximity of the vote to next week's presidential election. According to the AP, no other Supreme Court justice has been confirmed in a recorded vote with no support from the minority party in at least 150 years. Barrett is the third justice on the 9-member court to be nominated by President Donald Trump and significantly tips its ideological balance toward a 6-3 conservative majority. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas swore in Barrett at a White House ceremony later Monday evening. Democrats argued that the decision of picking a nominee for the seat should have been left up to whatever candidate wins a U.S. presidential election next week, a stance Republicans held when there was an election year vacancy in early 2016. At the time, Republicans refused to consider Democratic President Barack Obama's nomination of another appellate judge, Merrick Garland. Barrett could potentially consider election disputes involving President Trump, although it is unclear whether she might recuse herself since Mr. Trump named her to the court. She declined to say at her confirmation hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee 2 weeks ago whether she will avoid hearing disputes over extended deadlines for voters to return mail-in ballots and other issues Republicans and Democrats have been contesting. Barrett almost assuredly would be among the justices hearing a new challenge on November 10th on whether to invalidate the country's Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, which President Trump has sought to overturn. This is VOA News. Some 60,000 people fled their homes near Los Angeles Monday as a fast-spreading wildfire raged across more than 3,000 hectares, blocking key roadways and critically injuring firefighters. The Silverado Fire erupted early in the morning in the foothills of Irvine, about 600 kilometers southeast of Los Angeles. It spread quickly, fueled by dry conditions and erratic winds that prevented firefighting aircraft from flying. The inferno nearly quadrupled in size by afternoon, jumping a highway and covering the area with a huge plume of smoke and ash. About 20,000 homes have been evacuated, along with several public schools that are set to remain shut Tuesday. The National Weather Service warned that the combination of low humidity, dry vegetation, and strong winds had created the most dangerous fire weather conditions this year, and said the region will remain under a red flag warning signifying a high risk of wildfire through Tuesday evening. U.S. President Donald Trump and Democratic challenger Joe Biden both made campaign stops in the U.S. state of Pennsylvania Monday in two entirely different styles. Biden was not expected to make campaign appearances Monday, but showed up unexpectedly in the city of Chester near Philadelphia to meet with a few campaign volunteers and reporters. Pennsylvania is a crucial state for U.S. presidential candidates, carrying a big chunk of Electoral College votes that can make or break a run for the presidency. While Biden wore a mask and kept his appearance low-key, U.S. President Trump addressed boisterous rallies in a series of three appearances in the state. He told his audience in Allentown, Pennsylvania, that we win Pennsylvania, we win the whole thing. More than 60 million Americans have already cast ballots ahead of the November 3rd election next week, a record-breaking pace that could lead to the highest U.S. voter turnout by percentage in more than a century. Surging coronavirus cases in many parts of the country have dominated the campaign, along with news of a COVID-19 outbreak within Vice President Mike Pence's staff. Experts say the arrival of the first COVID-19 vaccine will not mean people can throw their mask away. For starters, they say a vaccine may not be 100% effective. Vanderbilt University infectious disease expert William Schaffner told VOA recently that a vaccine is not likely to be a suit of armor. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has set the bar for COVID-19 vaccine efficacy at 50%. Seasonal flu vaccines, for example, have ranged from 60% effective at best to 10% at worst in recent years. Experts say a partially effective vaccine might help high-risk groups like frontline workers or those with underlying health problems, but it may not be right for the general population. Find more at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya's president unveils a long-awaited constitutional review report.
When we sat down to speak, he said, let us fix that which ails us that will allow us in future to be able to compete without the need for innocent Kenyan blood to be shed.
Press freedom groups accuse Tanzania authorities of media suppression ahead of Wednesday's presidential election. Pre-election violence in Ivory Coast raises concerns. Zimbabwe hopes a new farming technique will help end food shortages. And some Nigerians remain skeptical as the judicial panel begins an investigation into police brutality.
A welcome development. However, you need to realize that the government has exhausted credibility limits of the Nigerian people. And so believability by the people is very, very slim.
And this morning, we'll have a discussion with a Nigerian immigrant who is running to be a judge in Ramsey County, Minnesota. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. President Uhuru Kenyatta and opposition leader Raila Odinga yesterday, Monday, officially launched the much-awaited Building Bridges Initiative, the BBI, at the Bowmans. As Atiendo Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, the BBI seeks to amend 58 articles of the Constitution, including the executive, legislature, and the judiciary.
Speaking at the launch on Monday at the Bomas of Kenya, President Kenyatta said the law review process under Building Bridges Initiative will culminate in an inclusive governance structure that will enhance unity and cooperation among Kenyans. He urged Kenyans to read and support the Building Bridges Initiative because it will end the tribal divisions that have characterized successive elections in the country. Mr. Kenyatta also thanked opposition leader Raila Odinga for the 2018 handshake, which he termed as a watershed moment that has drawn the country's political landscape.
I want to also recognize at this moment my brother Raila Odinga, because as many of you know, we were competitors in 2017. And as such, things got to a very difficult level. But when we sat down to speak, something that was very difficult, he said that let us get together and let us fix that which ails us that will allow us in future to be able to compete without the need for innocent Kenyan blood to be shed.
Also speaking from the same podium, opposition leader Raila Odinga said that the 2010 Constitution was a ceasefire document, and now is the time for Kenya to look at the issues that were not addressed during the Constitution drafting process. Mr. Odinga dismissed claims that he was pushing the BBI as a way for him to become president, saying he was yet to declare his interest in the presidency.
When we sat together, we agreed that it was time to look at some of the issues ailing our country. Because in spite of having passed this constitution, which has been hailed all over the world as one of the most democratic constitutions, still we have a problem as a people. So what is it that is missing that needs to be fixed so that Kenyans can march on as a people who are proud and who are happy? That was the essence of that conversation that we had. This is not about making Uhuru Kenyatta a prime minister or a Odinga a president.
However, Deputy President William Ruto took to the same podium and expressed his reservations about the BBI report in its current form, saying the review should reflect the needs of all Kenyans. One of the sections the Deputy President touched on is the issue of the National Police Service.
The 2010 Constitution was very clear that the police must act independently of any politicians, whether they are in government or in the opposition, to recommend that we will have a police council chaired by a CS is actually a derogation from the independence of the police.
Most speakers at the launch supported the BBI, which proposes, among others, various changes in governance, such as inclusion of the post of prime minister and two deputies to be appointed by the president. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
Press freedom groups and journalists have accused Tanzania's government of silencing critics of President John Magufuli ahead of the October 28 election. Tanzanian authorities this year suspended a number of media groups from broadcasting or publishing, raising concerns about growing censorship. Charles Kumbe reports from Dar es Salaam.
As Tanzanians prepare to vote for a president on October 28, Press freedom groups say media critics of the government have been targeted in a campaign of intimidation. The Media Institute of Southern Africa and Tanzania, MISA, says that in the days leading up to the election, they have recorded a number of incidents of police harassing reporters. MISA chairperson Salome Kitomari says the organization has been trying to work with the police to ensure journalists are protected. She says there have been incidences of journalists attacked or targeted when performing their duties, and this is what made them collaborate and discuss the issue. Police should first inspect areas where political events are held to ensure that they are safe for journalists, says Kitomari, and also to advise them. Allegations of censorship have increased in the run-up to Tanzania's election, with communication authorities suspending and fining several media that reported opposition criticism. Online channel Kwanza TV lost its license after posting a speech by opposition leader Tundu Lissu, which authorities called seditious. President of the Tanganyika Law Society, Rugemeleza Nshala, says authorities are using the law to whittle away at press freedoms. He says Article 18 of Tanzania's constitution guarantees people's right to search, access, and disseminate information. It doesn't have any restrictions, says Inshallah. It is clear. It does not say your right is according to the law, he says. But the right thing is only for people to share valid information. So, concludes Inshallah, it is high time the government respects that. Halifa Saidi is an independent investigative journalist who lost his job in March at a leading English newspaper in the country, The Citizen. He was fired after tweeting that the opposition should take to the streets to demand a new constitution instead of waiting to be elected. Saidi says fear and self-censorship have become the norm among Tanzanian journalists.
Fear of being denied of press card when your current press card expires. Fear of being kidnapped, fear of being charged with money laundering. So all of these factors, all of these issues make, journalists, any journalist in Tanzania, think twice before doing any particular story.
Tanzanian authorities have dismissed the accusations that press freedoms have been limited and say that all media can operate as normal if they obey the law. The Reporters Without Borders 2020 World Press Freedom Index ranks Tanzania 124th out of 108 countries. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
Ivory Coast has seen violence ahead of an October 31st election, with analysts worried about further clashes. Opposition parties announced a boycott of the election and urged civil disobedience among their supporters. As Stacey Knott reports from Accra, Ghana, the unrest has raised concerns in the region and brought a halt to tourism.
In 2010, the nation fell into crisis after then-president Laurent Gbagbo refused to concede defeat in elections to Alassane Ouattara, sparking a conflict which killed about 3,000 people. Since then, the nation has seen a dramatic change. Under his two terms, Ouattara has overseen strong economic growth, as well as security reforms and improvements in livelihoods. However, instead of stepping down this year, he is running for a third term. He insists that his first two terms do not count towards term limits because the 2016 constitution was not in force at that time. His opponents argue this is illegal and want the Constitutional Council, which validated his candidacy, dissolved, along with the Independent Electoral Commission. Christopher Fomonye, the Regional Director for Central and West Africa at the International Democratic Institute for International Affairs, said 2020 was meant to be the consolidation of gains made over the past decade. He says a stable Ivory Coast is important to all of West Africa.
It's an important hub for the coastline countries, but also for countries in the Sahel, which depend on ports in Abidjan and in Cote d'Ivoire to be able to export their products. And so if Cote d'Ivoire is thriving and doing well economically and politically stable, that would mean very well for a number of other countries. It would also mean very well for the Ivorians.
Ryan Cummings, the director of the Africa-focused risk management consultancy, Signal Risk, said Ivory Coast was seen as a success story in state building after the 2010 crisis. Despite the current tensions, he does not think the nation will see a repeat of 2010.
there were a lot of triggers at that time, you know, for the sustained and pervasive unrest we saw after those elections, but which are absent now, and where elections themselves are no longer seen as zero-sum games. That election outcome, which is disputed or controversial, will necessarily kind of catalyze significant violence that will derail a lot of the gains that the country's made.
While Ivory Coast has a diverse economy, the tourism sector has seen gains over the past decade. Ata Biriako Koldam Jr., who works in a seaside hotel, says the run-up to the election has kept away visitors who were just starting to come back after COVID-19 restrictions.
It's affected businesses, and we are just praying that things will go smoothly during the election so that the hospitality or the tourism business will come back again.
Jessica Moody, a political risk analyst especially focused on Ivory Coast, also worries about violence this week.
I think we'll probably also see, though, that quite a lot of people are, you know, trying to stay out of the way. I think there's a lot of people who are scared of a repeat of 2010. A lot of people fleeing the areas that are most dangerous. I've heard of lots of people getting out of Abidjan, even trying to flee the country, actually, because they're so scared of what might happen.
Moody said the ideal way forward is for the government to allow open dialogue, for the election to be postponed, and for Ouattara not to run. However, she said this wish list was highly unlikely, and that no matter what, the results are going to be contested because, in her words, no one trusts the institutions that are charged with overseeing it. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 27th. Concerned Nigerians, a political pressure group, says the beginning of an investigation into police brutality in Lagos State is a welcome development. Deji Adeyanju, convener of the group and one of the major organizers of the youth protests, also says there is a need for the government to be genuine in addressing the rest of the key demands of the protesters. Meanwhile, President Muhammadu Buhari has called for calm as judicial panel in the commercial capital Lagos began an investigation on Monday into allegations of police brutality. Deji Adeyanju tells viewers Peter Clotty that his group is calling on Nigerians who have been victims of police brutality and extrajudicial killings to present evidence to the panel.
I would like to first by saying that it's a welcome development. However, you need to realize that the government has exhausted its credibility limit to the people, the Nigerian people. And so believability by the people is very, very slim. So you find out that most of the case, the people are not, they do not trust the government. And once trust is misplaced or missing, you know, you cannot really achieve much. However, this is not to say that nothing good will come out of this judicial panel of inquiry. But however, we are urging on the people, you know, to use this medium in order to document rights abuses, you know, violations, and all the victims that have suffered in one way or the other during the ENTSAS protests in Lagos should visit the panel, you know, and properly, you know, document their complaints before the panel, and that we should give the panel the benefit of doubt to do the right thing.
So what do you think both the state government and the federal government can do that you think would help ease the tension and meet the demands of the protesters, including your group?
Yeah, very simple. You know, there are the five demands. You know, government can begin to show commitment by immediately implementing those demands so that this ban on ENSAS, this ban on the Session Robbery Squad will not be another audio ban like what we have witnessed in the past. You know, so for us, we are of the view that the ban be properly done this time around, and that the new tactical unit that has been nicknamed SWAT, you know, be done in such a way, in a transparent manner, to show to the Nigerian people that government is sincere this time around. You know, so, government must earn the trust of the people by doing what is right.
If you say by doing what is right, what specific measures are you talking about? Because the president has called for calm as state government tries to find ways to resolve the concerns or meet the demands of the protesters. So what more can be done?
A good start would be, you know, setting up a fund for victims of violations by the police and tell people to come forward. You know, we just saw a report that over 30,000 people have been killed in SAS detention facility. The report is out there on social media. So you can imagine the pain of those families.
Are you anticipating more protests despite the fact that state government and federal government are taking steps to address your concerns?
If demands and concerns are not met, of course, protests will most likely continue nationwide. Trust me.
Deji Adeyanju is one of the leading organizers of the youth protest in Nigeria. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. Zimbabwe authorities are hailing a sustainable farming technique called Fumuza as a breakthrough to help end the country's long-standing food insecurity. But as Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, some critics point to its limits.
Zimbabwe is hoping to one day regain its former title as the breadbasket of Southern Africa. 52-year-old George Nyamakawa from Murewa district, about 100 kilometers east of Harare, is one of millions of farmers authorities are training through a United Nations bag program called Fumvuza. Fumvuza, which means early shoots in Shona, is a method of conservation agriculture that focuses on small plants which retain water easily and is more efficient than large-scale plowing.
It is easy to maintain. At the same time, it gives more food to the nation.
The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, has trained government officials on the method to help combat food shortages that have plagued Zimbabwe for over a decade. Zimbabwe's government has touted the program as a possible food security solution. But the UN World Food Program notes it is still providing food aid to about 8 million Zimbabweans, more than half the population. Niels Belzer is the WFP's Zimbabwe Deputy Director.
I think it will take a bit more time to really work towards zero hunger and eradicate the problem altogether. But indeed, we have a La Nina season ahead. That means normal to above normal rainfall, which the scientists predict. So we're very happy about that. And combined with the Pumvuta approach or method, I think it will make a difference and we can increase the output.
Early shoots farming has its limitations, says Mandevamba Rukuni, a former agriculture economics professor at the University of Zimbabwe, who now directs a charity focused on farming innovation in Africa.
Fumvuza, whilst it is a good idea in terms of easily available technology, anyone can dig a small hole and ensure that you plant at a certain point and water is retained. So in that sense, it's good to promote the idea. The disadvantages, like anything else, are there. And the main one is it's very labor-intensive. And Zimbabwe, like most other countries, labor is becoming more and more scarce, especially in rural areas. People are moving to urban areas.
Farmers like Nyamakawa say are willing to do the extra work if the yields are higher and if they can count on authorities for support. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare.
On November 3rd, next Tuesday, Americans will vote for president and national and local legislators. There are also many candidates with ties to Africa who are running for various elected positions locally around the country. Between now and November 3rd, Daybreak Africa will attempt to bring you interviews with some of them. This morning, a discussion with Ngozi Azubuke, originally from Nigeria. She is running for judge in Ramsey County, Minnesota. Azubuke says she wants to be a judge because there is lack of equality in access to justice. She also says you can achieve the American dream if you set goals for yourself and are willing to work hard to achieve those goals.
I'm running because we all are aware that systematic disparity on equal access to justice exists. And the manner that we appoint judges to the bench is flawed, seriously flawed, because we lack diversity in the pool of attorneys selected for appointment. I believe that judges should represent the communities that we serve. I bring with me variety of experience and background, and being an immigrant and a woman as well, I bring another form of diversity to the bench, which our county really needs at this time.
What message do you have for people, say, in your native Nigeria and Africa in general, in terms of achieving the American dream?
We Africans, typically, we are very hardworking. And I think that's part of the thing that helped me. And we have one faith or the other. And that's also helpful in terms of adversity. So the advice I give to people is to be prepared to work hard. Have a goal for yourself. Be determined to achieve the goal. And one can really, truly achieve one's goal in an honest way here, as long as we set a goal for ourselves, work hard towards the goal, and don't forget to ask for help. Most of the time, we are too proud to ask for help, but we need to ask for help when we need help, knowing that, one, adversity does not define who a person is, and if adversity does not define who you are, feel free to ask for help when you need the help, and be humble enough to receive the help and work towards the goal, so that you will be in a position as well to help others.
You have said that you will be a judge who believes that it is possible for humanity and justice to exist. What exactly do you mean?
I believe when it comes to justice, humanity should not be thrown out of the door, because we are dealing with human beings. We are not dealing with inanimate objects. And so I believe that it's possible for justice and humanity to coexist. There's a way in the delivery of justice, in the dispensation of justice, it can be done. That even though it doesn't mean that you're absolving the person of the responsibility or accountability, but it can be done in a manner that the outcome will be fair, the outcome will be humane.
And Ngozi Akubuke, I want to wish you success and good luck in your desire to be the next judge of Ramsey County, Minnesota. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Ngozi Azubuke, originally from Nigeria, is running to be a judge in Ramsey County, Minnesota. She was speaking with us from Minneapolis. And that's it for this Tuesday, October 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a great day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
Straight Talk Africa is celebrating its 20th anniversary. Longtime host Shaka Sali talks about his career, the newsmakers he interviewed, and his audience. Be sure to join us on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, Afrobeat to Ndumbulu and Makosa to Kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.